You're listening to Wheelationships.
Okay, we have just a couple more weeks on this subject, smart people, dumb choices. Back at the beginning, we mentioned the different categories of dumb choices that we can make. We can make dumb moral choices. In church, we tend to talk about these a lot, the dumb moral choices. When we follow emotions such as greed and pride, we're following sinful impulses, and sinful impulses always lead to dumb choices, dumb moral choices. Two emotions we haven't talked about, and we're really not going to talk about them, is our lust and temptation, because those are kind of obvious, and they obviously are a source of dumb moral choices. So, but we also make dumb relational choices. We make dumb financial business choices, dumb health choices, and dumb practical choices. So we mentioned those at the beginning of this. But besides those categories and beyond the emotions that we've talked about, like stress and insecurity that Trudy's talked about the last couple of weeks, there are also three important factors that sometimes come into play in the choices that we make. And as we've been talking about the emotions, we've kind of mentioned these factors, but I want to explicitly mention these factors now. So these are not words that are going to be unfamiliar. And the first one we want to talk about is influence. Influence. We can be influenced into making dumb choices. And most of the time, it's not external influences that are at work. It's internal influences that we have going on that either push or pull us towards dumb choices. The thing about these influences and the other emotions that we've talked about is none of them appear or feel dumb when we experience them. If they felt dumb, we probably wouldn't follow them. But because they don't naturally feel dumb, it's sort of like a riptide. And thus the title of our lesson this morning, Fighting the Tide. A riptide, when you're caught in a riptide, what's the first impulse? It's to swim directly against that tide, to try to get back to shore as fast as possible because you're being pulled out to sea and it's like, oh my goodness, and you try to get back. Well, we're told that's the wrong thing to do. The thing to do is to run parallel to the shore till you get out of that pull, and then you can get back to shore. But the first instinct, while seemingly the smart thing to do, is not, because you quickly tire yourself out and you're done. So that's kind of how it is with these influences, with the emotions that we've talked about. Our first instinct is usually not the best instinct, unless we've trained ourselves to do otherwise. So you know, if that's why we hear, well, but that's how I react. I just react. I don't think about it. Exactly. We don't think about it. And that's how we end up in the dumb choices. Something we talked about when we talked about anger is an expectation of fairness. Expectation of fairness. What we often seek is something that's called procedural justice. It's not so much that things didn't work out our way. We want to know that the process is fair. Or at least that we've been included in the process. That we've been heard, that we've been considered, that we've been... And so when we feel like we're not getting procedural justice, when we feel like we're not part of the process, when we feel like things haven't been fair, then we're liable to do something stupid, like blow away a guy. I don't know. We'll debate whether that was stupid or not. I don't know. But in fact, what we tend to do is we tend to focus on the unfairness more than the actual goal that we first had. You know, in that instance, the goal that they first had was to get the little thing. And, you know, he was probably more satisfied that he showed up the guy and got revenge or that. And that's what we tend to do. We tend to shift our focus and it becomes the unfairness that becomes our focus. And it leads us into really, really dumb choices. You know, I'll teach them a lesson. I'll get them. I'll show you, my little pretty. Whether we're the one that feels shortchanged or we're the one that's making the decision, we can help ourselves or we can help the other person if we simply communicate and bring the process into play. If you're making a decision, you can help the other person from making their own dumb decision by just giving them the sense that you've considered them, you've, you know, considered their input, and you can maybe short circuit a future dumb decision they may make, you know, maybe a tantrum or something, if you simply bring out the process. When decisions are made and we feel like there's no regards to our input, that the decisions are just put on us, that there's no concern for us, we're not as likely to feel heard. We're not as likely to feel that the whole thing was fair. So we have to get away from that feeling of it's all about the fairness. No, it's not all about the fairness. Got to go back to what's the goal? Another interesting influence is the influence of money and altruism. I like these $5 words. Money and altruism. Scientists they've identified two interesting parts of your brain. The first is called the nucleus accumbens, the ones you have all studied, I'm sure. This is called the pleasure center of your brain because it gives us pleasure. The nucleus accumbens. It's activated by certain drugs such as cocaine, amphetamines, opium, heroin. Not sure about chocolate. Okay, I believe you on that one. And alcohol activates this. The nucleus accumbens, along with the ventral tegmental area, known as the VTA. I know. This area gives you the release of dopamine and serotonin, and we've talked about those two substances before in your brain. They give us pleasure. Want a picture? There's a picture coming up. Come on. You. I'm talking to you. There you go. So you got the, there's the nucleus accumbens is in that part. And the VTA is over here. And they connect with each other. They have this relatively basic part of your brain. And then you got other letters, which I don't know what they mean. You got a pag and a hip and a... You didn't know your hip was there. But anyway, VTA is right there and your NA is right there. And so they communicate with each other. And they're the pleasure center. Now, scientists are interested in that pleasure center because it's what helps drive addictive behavior. Because they're activated, the pleasure centers are activated by these substances. When those two things, the dopamine and the serotonin, when they're released in your brain, it gives you pleasure. But once they're activated, it takes more of a stimuli to release more of those in your brain each time. So, you know, you get a hit, and then it takes a little bit more the next time, and it takes a little bit more the next time. Takes a little bit more, and it drives that. It helps drive the addictive behavior. And so scientists have studied that area of your brain. Now, there's a different part of your brain, which I don't have a picture for because it's on the other side. I tried. It's on the other side. Yeah. So it's on the other side. So it's called the. You want the name for that one? Posterior superior temporal sulcus. Sulcus. It's there. I don't know what it means. Now, this other part of your brain is activated under very different circumstances. That this area of the brain, we'll just call it the social center of the brain, the social center, because that's the area that's responsible mostly for our social interactions, for how we perceive others, how we relate to others. We'll have you up to teach later. And how we form bonds. It's the social center. Now, let's cover something else. We mentioned this big $5 word. Altruism is the unselfish regard and concern for the welfare of others. Now, researchers have found that when we're altruistic, when that is when we unselfishly serve, when we unselfishly care for and give to others, that other part of the brain, the social center, lights up. When we're altruistic, when we just don't have any regard for ourselves, but we give to others, the social center of the brain just lights up. Boom. It's working. So the question is, what do those two parts of the brain have to do with each other? How do they relate? Well, not only is the pleasure center of the brain activated by drugs and alcohol, it's activated by other things, such as probably chocolate, financial compensation. Somebody, you know, you get a reward, or you get a unexpected bonus, or you get a raise. The pleasure center lights up. The more money we make, in fact, the more that pleasure center of the brain lights up. Biologically speaking, making money can be like getting a little line of cocaine. In both instances, our pleasure center lights up. And what happens, do you think, when we do something selfless, when we serve somebody, when we unselfishly give ourselves on behalf of the other? When we give money instead of get money, what happens in the pleasure center? Nothing. Zip. Not a thing. Pleasure center, perfectly quiet. The social center lights up, but the pleasure center is absolutely quiet. Not only true of money, it's true of any kind of a reward of any size. Could be a little thing, could be a big thing. Pleasure center, nothing. That's what I'm told, what I read. What the researchers have found is that we can be doing something from unselfish motives for God, for country, for ideals, for the common good, for the general welfare. But when the promise of reward gets involved, the pleasure center takes over. Because rewards have to do with the pleasure center, not the social center. And we begin to chase the thrill of the reward, no matter how unselfish we think we are. In fact, scientists tell us that those two parts of the brain can't light up at the same time. That when the pleasure center is activated, it begins to do the work. It begins to drive the show. Once again, Scripture already tells us this, and scientists kind of confirm it. You can't serve God and money. Now, how does this lead us to dumb decisions? I can't tell you how many times I've heard somebody say, it's not about the money. It's always about the money. If we just naturally follow our inward impulses, it's about the money. Bank on it. If money's involved, you don't know what you want. I've heard people say, well, I'm trying to figure this out, and I'm just trying to, you know, it's not about the money. Well, it's about the money. If money's involved, it's about the money. And if money's involved, many times we don't know what we want because we're just tend to be that way. Proverbs says, such is the fate of all who are greedy for money. It robs them of life. See, rewards are fine. Good performance should be rewarded. And if good performance is rewarded, that's not a problem. It's the anticipation of reward that drives the pleasure center. It's the anticipation of, see, that's the way it is in an addict. It's the anticipation of the pleasure that drives them. It's the next hit. It's the next. And that's the way it is with the monetary rewards. It's the anticipation of the reward that tends to be the problem for us and tends to short circuit that social center. So how do we make better decisions? Well, we need to embrace God's rewards. We need to embrace God's rewards. We have to understand that that's the way our minds work. And we have to understand that God tells us how to handle this. He says, that's why I tell you not to worry about everyday life, whether you have enough food and drink or enough clothes to wear. Isn't life more than food and your body more than clothing? Okay. Get your mind off of that. Get it back to what I've called you to do. Seek the kingdom of God above all else and live righteously, and he will give you everything you need. We have to actively embrace that. Clearly, we have to embrace it. We have to hold it. We have to cling to it. We have to give it all we've got. Because even if just a little bit, as he also says elsewhere, a little leaven leavens the whole batch. Just a little bit gets in and it can ruin you. His kingdom, his righteousness. Otherwise, why? The proverb says we end up being robbed of life. Whether it's money or sex or just general physical or emotional pleasure. If that gets involved as our motivation, we tend to stop doing for others. So James 4:4 says, don't you realize that friendship with the world makes you an enemy of God? I say it again, if you want to be a friend of the world, you make yourself an enemy of God. See, it tends to be a kind of that way. Scientists just confirm it for us. Another influence and the last one I want to talk about today is pressure to conform to the group. That's what we mean when we talk about peer pressure. What we're really saying, it's not just pressure, it's pressure to suppress a dissenting opinion. It's funny, if you watch it, and I've been in meetings, been in different situations where you have someone that is promoting an opinion, and there are people in the group that know it may not be like the best way to go, but nobody wants to speak up. Because there's this pressure of, well, we don't want to be seen as the bad guy. We don't want to be seen as the nag or the downer. We don't want to be seen as disloyal, all these kind of things. And there's a pressure to conform. It might mean everyone else says, well, let's go see this movie. And we should say, well, it's a good movie, but, you know, there's some stuff in here we really, you know, are bad. We shouldn't be watching, but we don't say anything because there's a pressure to conform. Or perhaps the boss says, let's do this. And no one wants to say why that's not a good idea because we don't want to be out of sync with the group. Now, we've seen this demonstrated many times on shows like you've seen it on What Would You Do? My girls love that show. What would you do? It's an ABC thing, you know, and not all of them, but she dissents. Well, here's a piece of video that demonstrates, not from that show, different piece of video. Here we go. I thought she was dead, and then I thought maybe she wasn't. That's what she said. There's this, you know, it's more than just the pressure we sometimes feel is, in this instance, was to ignore a need. But there's also the pressure, as I said, this not speak up sometimes when everybody else seems to be on board. There are, and I've listed them here in group dynamics, the four types. There's four types of members in every group, in every family, in every church, in every meeting, in every conference, in every informal collection of people. Like they said there, that was kind of an informal group that had kind of agreed not to step in and help. And there's four types of members in every group. So quickly, there are initiators, there are blockers, there are supporters, and there are observers. Those are four types of people you have. Initiators are those that get things going. They're the ones that come up with the ideas. Initiators are the ones that say, hey, what's a good idea? We should. Those are the initiators. They get things. No, that's right there. They're generally looked on as the positive people. They're looks because they move the group to action. They say, let's do this. Blockers are usually not looked at so favorably. Blockers are the ones that are referred to as the wet blanket, the party poopers, the balloon busters. They're the ones that say, you know, I'm not so sure that jumping off the cliffs is a good idea. I'm thinking maybe. Supporters step in and they either favor one side or the other. They either go with the initiators, they go with the blockers. And observers, obviously, are the ones that try to stay neutral and they don't say a whole lot. They may say, we seem to have a problem here. But they don't really take sides. So you have those four type of members. And usually, once the initiator steps up, and that's one hard part, is to be the initiator. When the group seems to be stuck in this is the way things are done, the initiators will be the one that steps up and say, let's get out of that. So that's one hard part. But the other hard part is to be the blocker. Because you don't want to be seen as the negative person. You don't want to be seen as the stick in the mud, as the drag, as the negative one, as the complainer, as the whiner. So it tends to be hard. But what we have to understand in every group is the blocker is necessary. The blocker is really important because pretty much every good idea can be improved. And the problem in many cases is good ideas aren't improved or kind of bad ideas aren't blocked. In that case, it kind of was the reverse. The idea was we're not going to help. And it took a blocker to say, you know, maybe this isn't a good idea. Maybe we should attack this differently and actually walk up and see if the person's dead. NASA has studied plane crashes. They studied cockpit recordings. And you remember the crash we talked about several weeks ago, the Tenerife disaster where over 500 people died. In that story, the co-pilot, when the pilot said, okay, we've had enough, let's go, let's hit it. The co-pilot said, but we haven't received clearance yet. And the pilot said, fine, go ahead and clear us. And then they didn't really receive full clearance. And the pilot started again. And the second time, the co-pilot didn't say anything. And he was kind of under that influence of the pilot's God. After all, my pilot is ahead of the safety thing. And he was afraid to block. He was afraid to move out and block anymore because he didn't want to be seen as negative. He didn't want to be seen as disloyal to his pilot. And it caused a big problem. And this is how it can be in a group. So real quickly, effective blocking. Okay, because we need to know how to block. And this goes to conflict. This goes to sometimes we don't know how to properly have conflict. And we're afraid of it. We don't want to be the blocker. Or maybe we block badly. So let's, real quick, effective blocking. First of all, state the facts. State the facts. A lot of airlines have instituted what they've learned from NASA's collection of data from cockpit recordings and how this works. And they've said, you know, if there's a problem, anybody in the cockpit should be able to say, you know, this is off. Our approach speed is off. Maybe, you know, and just state the facts. You don't have to do anything more than that. And that sometimes is enough to make the initiator say, oh, yeah. For us, it might be, you know, that's not in our budget. Yeah. That might be a good block. Okay. If that doesn't work, then maybe there's a challenge. Oops. Challenge. I see them. And it suggested use a first name and a quantifier. Use a first name such as Tim. You know, that's not in our budget. Maybe you should recheck your figures again. Maybe look in your wallet. I don't know. Just saying. Little challenge. For pilots, they're supposed to say something like, Mike, are we really going to make it on this approach? You should check your altitude. And the important thing here is not to be condescending. That's hard, okay? Don't be condescending in your challenge, but simply state the fact. Add a little name, add a qualifier, say, you know, let's think about this. Let's think about this. And again, this may just – sometimes we get tunnel vision when we get focused on a thing, and sometimes it just takes a little bit of a, hey, oh, what? Okay, yeah, you're right. We shouldn't do that. And thirdly, if all else fails, you might need to take action. And this goes back to what we talked about on boundaries. Here's what I'm going to do. Here's what I won't do. Now, you may think this is a good idea, but really, you know, in the pilot's case, what they're instructed to do is simply pick up the radio. Don't grab the controls. Don't try to wrest control from the pilot's hand. Just, you know, pick up the radio, call the tower. We're going to try approach again, tower. Is that all right? You know, go on. And it works. See, what it takes here is planning, and that's hard for us. Because, as I said, we get caught in the tide and we want to instinctively react, but sometimes we have to. So there's these influences that we need to be aware of, influences that we need to fight against. And next week we'll talk and we'll finish this series up. We've got a couple more factors that we want to talk about. Have a great week. We'll see you next week.